When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Good afternoon, good morning, good evening, wherever you are in the world. I'm Russell Tovey.
And I'm Robert Diamant.
And this is Talk Art.
Welcome to Talk Art.
How are you, Rob?
Today, Russell, I am feeling slippery.
Oh.
I'm in a state of ever-changing reality. And I feel like like today's guest is going to have a wonderful insight into this. Because one of the themes that has been running through their work since the early 1980s has been the plurality of the individual, which I think is such an interesting sort of concept, because I think so many of us believe that we know who we are, that we know what our identity is, that we know like the reality that we are living and, you know, the kind of fixed state of those around us, whether that be our employers or our family or even our favorite colors or, you know, kind of things that you believe to be true. But in fact, they can change and we are ever changing. And I think in this period of lockdown for the past year now, pretty much, because I think I did start in about February. I was like so paranoid. I started earlier than everyone else in the UK. But I think I've had these moments where, especially on weekends when I'm not working, that, you know, you might pour a glass of water and leave it on the side in the kitchen. And then when you come back an hour later, the light has so drastically changed that the reflections coming through that water, you know, suddenly looks like a different glass completely, even though it's the same glass. And I've had these moments which might seem quite strange to some of the listeners, but
very, very poetic.
Yeah, I know, but I sometimes look at the world like that. And I think that's in part thanks to the art that I've been exposed to. And I first saw this artist's work, our guest today, in about 2006 when I was 25. And I was in Edinburgh touring with my band, and I went to Inverleith House and saw an exhibition there and began exploring online, which at the time was actually a bit harder because I think it was images weren't loading as quickly, and I don't think as many people were even sharing as many images on their websites and stuff like that. But I learned a lot about a show that was happening in Zurich and also works that were in the Tate collection. And then Counter Editions did an amazing print of a kind of...
I love that, The Nest.
Yeah, The Nest, which has this beautiful egg repeated twice. So I began to kind of slowly take in this artist's oeuvre. I've learned so much, but I think, you know, partly from this artist's work and also other artists, you begin to look at the world and experience the world in a different way, you know, thanks to that, the way it changes your perception. So we would like to welcome to Talk Art, all the way from America, Ronnie Horn. Hi, Ronnie.
Hello there.
How are you today?
Well, after this last hurdle... Exhausted.
Yeah, I bet. You've been installing. I hear that you had snow blizzards, like trying to stop your installation, but you fought through.
We fought through the snow, and then the COVID brought us down.
Yes.
And we're going to rise again on Tuesday.
Wonderful.
To finish up, yeah.
Where are you in the world right now?
I'm in New York City.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. I have a studio in New York City.
And where else have you been during the lockdown? Have you been based in New York or have you been out of town?
Mostly I've been up at my other studio, which is upstate New York. It's about a three-hour drive from here.
Yeah?
Yeah, so it's kind of in a natural setting, and I found it very satisfying to be settled into nature in this kind of crisis period.
Absolutely. Well, it feels like nature, talking about nature, is a huge... motivation for your work and a huge recurring theme and a massive influence to your practice. It feels like the natural world and also kind of being solitary within the natural world really drives your practice forward.
It seems to. I mean, it wasn't something I set out to seek. I found myself in a way discovering that option. Which, because it isn't really the way I was brought up. So, and I think you may know already that Iceland was the key in the lock on that one.
Mm.
And then it kind of became a bigger part of my life off island living. So
growing up, you had quite a busy kind of life around you. And so you ended up seeking more solitary.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's I'm always at the risk of over articulating the why I did things. And in retrospect, their whys are easy to grab. But the reality at that time, or the actual, I don't know what it was. I think that there are a lot of reasons for me going off toward preferring solitude. And the key was probably because of this murky reality of my gender. You know, which is like before I got to sexuality, I had this kind of ambivalence, which took the form of my gender is no one's fucking business.
Uh-huh.
Except that was just like a very idealistic thought, but it made a lot of sense to me. And because I was given the option to be either, at least visibly, publicly, I wanted to play that. I wanted to play the card, which was not about a kind of a sex appeal card, which, you know, let's face it, that's a huge card to throw away when you're like 7 years old or something. But I did not feel a strong connection to either gender. So I almost didn't have a choice. I was kind of just, I knew that I was not a mainstream. Mainstream was not an option for me, mm-hmm. you know. And I think that affected my need to be solitary, because I wouldn't say that was an easy road back then.
Yeah.
For me, it's not in my family, and definitely not in public school.
Right. So, and at 19, you took yourself off to Iceland. Is that right?
Yes, 19. That's correct. First time I left the country, I went to Iceland.
But why Iceland? The first place you visit when you leave America is Iceland at 19. Is kind of adventurous on your own. Is
well, no, I wasn't on my own. Oh. I was with my girlfriend.
Oh, right.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
You know.
Why did you romantic
here? The plot is thickening.
The plot's thickening.
Yeah, I wouldn't say that.
What was Iceland then? What was the pull of Iceland for both of you then?
For Ditto, her mother had been there in 19, I think it was 55.
Mm-hmm.
And she flew over, and guess who was on the plane?
Bjork?
William Faulkner.
William
who?
Faulkner.
William Faulkner, who was picking up his Nobel Prize, and he went through Iceland. Wow. So she took this walk with him during the stopover, and had this come. And I just, you know, and I grew up. I always loved Faulkner. He's one of the first authors I remember having a strong connection to. Oh. And so that was one thing for sure. And Ditto was in on that with me. But the other thing was that I had a natural affinity for islands. And I think I was interested in the lack of development in Iceland, that you could go there. And not everything was commercialized. The economy was so small that people had to take responsibility, you know.
Mm-hmm.
It was more of a socialist economy, I would say, a more functional socialist economy. There were 175,000 people back then masquerading as a country. Now it's 350 and getting larger.
Mm-hmm.
But I do think that it's a real gift to have a small economy. You don't have the complexities of scale and the lack of control that we all seem to have embraced recently.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so I think my attraction to Iceland was really the fact of the island, that little anecdote that I told you about. I also had, and this is in this book I just published called Island Zombie. It's a short piece about growing up. When I was 8 years old, JFK was assassinated. Mm-hmm. It's 1963. Well, I think it was 2 weeks before that, or 2 weeks right around that time, when JFK, we were watching every detail, you know, nonstop on TV of analysis, the funeral commentary. And I was, you know, it was made a big impression on me. But then every now and then you'd get the news, you know, like what's going on beyond this horrific situation. Mm. And one of the things that was going on was this small island off the coast of Iceland was, you know, it was erupting from underneath the ocean. So it was just this funnel of steam coming up from the ocean. There wasn't even a landmass, but this was also being watched. It was like an eyewitness account of this assassination and the eruption. And the eruption was of a volcano called Surtsey, which literally came into existence in 1963. So I in my, you know, memory have those two images linked forever. And I like to think that was part of the reason I had this early connection to Iceland.
Yeah. So you were making work, you were taking photographs at the point when you went to this trip. This was like...
No. When I went on this trip, when I was 19, it was just a lark.
Yeah.
And when I got there, it was, you know, earth-shattering for me. There was no chance I wouldn't come back, you know. And I didn't know it would become migratory, you know, and throughout my life. But I knew, and part of it was that everything at that time was so self-evident: the geology, the weather, even the architecture. Everything was, you know, you could see how things came to be what they were, and I was completely enthralled by that.
Wow. And and you're talking about the architecture of nature and how that...
Well, but, and also, no, the indigenous architecture.
Right, right,
like,
right.
You had, not a lot, but you had, at that time, you could see turf buildings.
Uh-huh.
You know, they make it and with this beautiful herringbone mm-hmm. pattern, how they lay the turf and build the walls, which you don't see it really except in museums now. But they used to build sheepfolds out of this turf style. They built their homes early on. You know, that was the main building material. And wonderfully, it just gets recycled. So I saw the history of the reclamation of this period of architecture. And then came the concrete. Like, you know, that became the dominant architecture. And, of course, that doesn't get reclaimed. So you see all these abandoned homes. But... Mm. That came more like in the mid to late 60s, I would say.
And when did these experiences of Iceland start to come into your practice, start to influence your work?
I would say not much later, because I was graduating from graduate school, and I was lucky to get a traveling grant, and I had based my proposal on going back to Iceland. And the plan for me, since I knew what Iceland was like from the one visit, I knew the best way to get around would be on a dirt bike, because it was really cheap to run, mm-hmm. a two-stroke engine. It was really cheap, and I could really get pretty much anywhere, including the interior, if I was brave enough. Or courageous enough, I don't know what the word is. So that was my plan. So I took the grant and I bought this Yamaha dirt bike, and I outfitted it with a special gas tank for long trips.
Oh, cool.
You know, and I just bulked up with you know, all of my camping equipment, and I hit the road, you know.
And your camera and everything, your camera equipment. On the back of the bike.
I did. I took it with me, but I realized that it was a mistake, because for this visit, which was I was hoping would be about 6 months, it forced me to have an agenda, to be looking a certain way at everything. And I didn't know what I was looking at, so I didn't want that agenda. So basically, I locked all my equipment in a locker at the bus shelter, you know, at the bus station. And I never took any pictures from that period, really.
Interesting.
And I don't regret it because I feel, I even had a grant from Polaroid. You know, Edwin Land was a really fascinating engineer. He's the man who invented the Polaroid technology. He was very interested in the arts and education. So no problem. They sent me like 500 boxes of this Polaroid shit. I had the camera from my father's pawn shop. And, you know, Polaroid at that time, those images were permanent.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? The black and white color, permanent. So it was really a fascinating technology. The problem was the packaging was so enormous, you know. And so the box of Polaroid was just, it was just not tenable for me to do this on a bicycle, on a motorcycle.
So you would
I had to ditch that idea as well.
So you just stayed, you were basically there in the moment, absorbing the environment. And that, I mean, that's quite an incredible choice. And I mean, were Polaroid and the people you got the grant from frustrated when you came back? You were like, I've seen a lot. I've not took any pictures.
You know, interestingly enough, with these grants, both of them, there were no strings attached. Because that's also something I'm not comfortable with, having to deliver to anybody but myself, to be honest.
And even at the beginning of your career, you felt that strongly towards that?
I think so. I'm too neurotic to make commitments, I think. It's too stressful and it alters the course of things, so I reject that option.
But that's quite an interesting lesson, though, to sort of have realised that you don't need to produce, you know, if even if you were there with that objective to take photographs, say, but to actually absorb things, look, experience. Because if you think about any great art, it normally comes out of a life experience of living and loving and losing and all of those things. And also, what was it like? Because you described going to Iceland as this kind of like you could see how things were made almost, like, you know, you understood how the house was made, or you could understand all of the actual kind of practical reality of real life. But isn't there this kind of like mystery and soul? And, you know, like if I think of your work to do with the geothermal pools, for example, and if you think about volcanoes, this kind of like unknown, like us as humans, how do we comprehend this kind of extremity of nature? Was that fascinating?
Well, I think that's a really interesting commentary, Robert. I talk about the transparency of Iceland, but that's not the half of it, because the source of things is, while that may be clear, it's not like it's visible. In the sense that the weather at that time, especially, it was generally colder. It was a lot windier and a lot wetter. So that meant that you almost could never see anything. So if I went back five times to the same thing, I'd be lucky if I got like, you know, 15-minute window to actually see what I'd been going to visit for years. And then that became fascinating to me. You know, that you go somewhere and you have one idea of it, and you come back and it's completely different because of the factors of what it is. And you spend your life getting to know one little supposedly finite place that turns out to be infinite. It's a sort of Emily Dickinson thing, you know, this idea of staying in one place to get at the whole world, which is what she did, you know, from my point of view anyway.
It's really interesting what you just said about looking at something at one point and then looking at it again and it's completely different, because that it feels like a running theme through your practice. Especially I'm thinking of a series about from the Thames. You took photographs of the Thames water, which I love, because, you know, we're in London, in the UK, and it's called the River Thames, for example, and it's part of the Tate collection, and it's 15 photographs with, and they have footnotes that go through them, which all reference literature historically about the Thames. So a lot of like tragedy, but other things about the mystery of water. But what I really find amazing, which made me really think, is that you've developed this doubling in your practice, which is kind of like a trademark, I guess, if I can say that about the work. But you would take a photograph of water, and then a split second later, you would take a photograph of the same section of water, and it will be completely different. And there's something about that which is fascinating, and that what you're just saying about how you go back to the same area, you migrate back to the same area every time, but you go back and you can be there and it can be completely different, even though it is the same.
Yeah, I think, and it's also something that's very much dependent on a viewer's disposition towards what's around them. And, as you know, like You Are the Weather, I don't know if you know that, it's from 1994, 500 shots of the same person taken in these hot pots, the geothermal waters of Iceland, right? And what I got from that was, here is a woman that I was working with for 6 weeks, and every time we set up, there was another essence being drawn from her face. Now, whether it was because it was a sunny day or a cloudy day or it was raining, and all of those things were happening. And it had this enormous influence, not only on what she looked like, but the energy she was putting out. So that really, you know, in terms of who she was that day, at least visually, was strikingly varied. So you had these, you know, a range of appearance in her. Where, given the fact that you're kind of using the same equation, so to speak, you're going to the hot spring, you're setting up the camera, you're looking at the same person, she's in the water, and the only thing that's really changing is place and weather. You know, even our camaraderie, that was a continuity throughout, you know, so that was the portrait. It was a portrait as much of a place as it was of a person. And the person was, again, for example, like the Thames was, for example. To go back to the Thames, the footnotes, there were a lot of quotes in there, but a lot of the material was taken from the newspapers and the police reports that I was able to read. The Thames is one river at the time it was reported to have the largest number of suicides in the world. Now, I don't know if that's true. Is all I know is it looks like it did.
Frequency.
So I went with it, right? Yeah. So, and I noticed when I looked at, when, you know, and I was, it was a kind of a commission piece. So I was looking at it, the river, and I found myself quite mesmerized by it.
Yes.
It was the darkness. It was the tidal thing. It was the sense that if you go in, you're not coming out, you know. Probably. It looked like it was a challenge. It was a wager. Can you stay out? You know, and a lot of people, I mean, I think the stories of people committing suicide also drew me even closer to the river to look at it. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, all of my commentary on it, which is introduces a playful element, I think, I hope. And so that river became kind of a center of my attention for a couple of years.
Absolutely. So just going back to You Are the Weather, did you double up the photographs as well in that series? Is that something that you did?
No, I didn't. With that series, I was working on a series of books called To Place.
Uh-huh.
They're Iceland-based. It's a series of, right now it's 10 volumes. I started in 1990. The last one was 2011. And they're based on my dialogue with Iceland, to place as in the verb, to place, as in the verb that a place is a changing thing. It's not a fixed entity. So that's the title. I know it's a little obscure and obnoxious in a way, mm-hmm. because it looks like I'm starting to say something and it ends right there. So to place... the first volume was a series of drawings I did. I was in a lighthouse for about 4 months in southern Iceland, 1982. And they're just, they're called Bluff Life. Like
you didn't have you didn't have to man the lighthouse. It was like a disused one, was it?
Or no, I knew it was automated.
Okay, good. You didn't have to go up there every hour and put the flashlight around, right?
But I got to tell you, it was something, it was really like having motivating force in there, some self-motivate. It was not exactly like a haunting, but you could, if you wanted to go there, you could get seriously scared.
Yeah.
It was like the building would just start moving. when this thing started up, because it was like many tons up in the tower, just grinding and grinding. And I have a lot of stories about being there, because it was really, you know, when I was going in the tent six for that 1979 trip, I was so out of it. I'd said, okay, I'm not even going to take anything to read. You know, which for me is radical.
Yes.
And okay, you're in a tent, right? Whatever. But you know, you do have downtime. Anyway, I did wind up having to go to Reykjavik and buy a few books. But there was just this idea. I didn't want anything between me and what was there. And of course, there is a lot between me and what's there. It's called my history, really, which I'm schlepping around with me. And it's informing everything I don't do and I do, and what my fears are and what my desires are, all of that. So, you know, it was just me testing myself, I think. I needed to know who I was outside of having been brought up in a context that was not, I was not an easy fit with. I needed to know who I was more stripped down on my own, you know, and I think that's why I did this trip.
Do you feel like that's a constant search for you, or do you feel like you've got to a point later on in your life where you are kind of, you've found where you fit?
I don't know if I found where I fit, but I know that I'm most comfortable in my solitude than anything else, you know. And having said that, I would say I am really very, very lucky with friends, you know, around the world. I mean, people that I can't live without. So it's a solitude in the local sense. But it's definitely a pleasure taken in society when it's necessary to me, which is basically when I travel for shows.
Right.
Because I've chosen not to travel for anything but business and Iceland, which is not business. It's just source. It's
research.
Muse. Iceland's my muse. I would say that, you know.
That's nice. Well, this thing about friends, then, this brings me on to another body of work, which is my most favourite of yours, which is called The Selected Gifts, which is from 1974 to 2015. And it's 67 inkjet photographs of presents that you have received from friends, family, people you've worked with over a period of 41 years. And then you photograph these, and some of them are from different angles. Some are doubled, some are single. But you photograph them with no hierarchy. There's no sentimentality. They're just an archive of these objects that you've received. And something about it, again, really inspired me, because it's you're saying what makes up a human, what's left behind. And it's the things we leave behind. Mm. But this is people's projections. A present is someone's projection of what they assume they know about you that you want to receive. And
yes,
you've created this body of work about that. And I find that absolutely fascinating, and also it appeals to the collector in me, because and the hoarder
yes,
and the archivist, because I'm suddenly like, you've hung on to these presents for 41 years and they are there being presented in this body of work. Can you talk a bit about that body of work, because for me that's like so exciting?
Well, I thought of it as a kind of vicarious self-portrait.
Yes,
you know, and I like that. That's kind of, that tickled me to, you know, have that idea that I was actually the reflection in the mirror, not the mirror. And when I started, it started out actually as a little, I'd sent a little, every New Year's I send a little print or a pamphlet or some concept piece, a limited edition of like 152 people that I want to have a moment of contact before the new year begins, you know? So one year I sent out something called My Gifts, a selection or something like that. It was a little chapbook, and it had a really list of all the things. So it was just written. There was no visual with it. And I think when I finished that, I realized that it was a visual thing and that these things were accessible to me. I guess one of the things that really grabbed me was the fact that at two very different times in my life, I was given the same book, The Book of Repulsive Women.
Yes.
I think that's a highlight for us. He was commenting.
Yeah, I saw that. Yeah, the book written by Juana Barnes.
Yes, exactly. Yes. And I didn't take it personally. I thought it was really.
But you got it twice. You still didn't take it personally.
I got it twice. And the same thing with Orlando, which was a little bit obvious for me, but okay.
Yeah.
But what's interesting is since that work was done, I was given Orlando yet again. So, right?
So funny.
I'll probably have a collection of Orlandos before I
That's another one. It's a side work.
Yeah. But a lot of these gifts that were given me, like there's a little love letter.
Yeah.
This was given to me by another artist, and it's one of his works. It was kind of a conceptual piece.
But there's a mystery to the people who, the gift givers. You didn't really...
Yeah, I didn't want to do that. I didn't want to give the names of the... Although in some cases it's there in the caption because, for example, it's a photograph by Jürgen Teller or something. Or whoever. There are some names in there. And usually, if it's self-evident in the object, I name it.
Right.
And if it's not, like this love letter, I don't bring up the name.
And do you want to keep it mysterious or would you reveal the identity?
I don't tell people. Right. I don't because I don't want really it going to that level of...
Intimacy.
Yeah. Maybe intimacy, but maybe just it doesn't really matter.
Yeah.
You know, even though they'll know who they are, it's a little bit like that. It's not gossip or it's not really adding anything conceptually to the work to say, oh, and, you know, because a lot of those things are from people that are certainly better known than I am. But, you know, I was feeling very modest about that.
Did anyone come along and get a bit upset that their gift wasn't photographed by you as part of the collection? Like, where's my panda I gave you? Why is that not being photographed?
Exactly. Well, I have found a number of gifts that I didn't include, but it wasn't because I edited them out. It's because I didn't remember them.
And I want to
have an addendum now.
Yes, another volume. Right? I want to know who got you the Flintstone figurines. Who got you an octopus? Who got you that octopus and the Flintstones?
I could give you the Flintstones because that is kind of historical. That was Felix Gonzalez Torres.
Oh, I knew it.
Those are his toys, yeah. There's a lot of Felix in there, actually. I think there are two or three things.
Wow.
He was a gift giver.
And he was someone that came into his life and he came into your life at a really wonderful moment for both of you. And you recognized each other's practices as mirroring each other and having a doubling as your work doubles, as his work doubles, as we know with Perfect Lovers, which is the two clocks and the empty bed with the two pillows. And your practice is always about doubling. What was that like to have that experience with him? Because he has been, and he's obviously a great gift giver, giving you the Flintstones. But what was that like at both of your career paths at that moment?
Well, I did a show in 1990 in LA. This was my first museum show at MoCA, and first museum show in the United States, which is at MoCA, LA. And I included a piece that I had actually produced I finished it in 1982, but I never had the right venue or setting to show this work, and so I never showed it until 1990. And that was a piece that one of the first times I met Felix and we were sitting and talking, and he brought up the Gold Field, which is this sculpture that I did and had shown at MoCA. It was called Forms from the Gold Field. It was just a sheet of gold laying on the ground, and it was curled over at one end, and it caught all of the ambient light, and it kind of ignited like it was on fire. It's quite spectacular if it's shown properly.
And it's natural light, or the gallery light. People thought that you'd lit onto it, hadn't they? But it was just refractions.
No, it was natural light. Yeah. There was no artificial light in that show. That's what LA is. You know, you can really get beautiful light. Yeah. So, And I was in the they called it the temporary contemporary, which was the Gary add-on, first manifestation of MoCA,
right.
You know, and it was all daylight. And I was just, so that piece was in there. And the first time I met Felix, he brought that experience up that he'd seen it, you know, and he talked about that work, and he'd seen it with his boyfriend, Ross, who had passed away. I'm not exactly sure what year, how long ago, but it was obviously a really traumatic thing, that loss. But he shared the viewing of the gold field with Ross. They were both there, right? So he would sort of triangulate me with Ross. So it was like, it was something very, very poetic and beautiful about it and organic to the way, his way of thinking. So Ross was always included in our early conversations that way. And I don't know, where was I going? Eventually I did the gold mats paired for Ross and Felix, mm-hmm. as a gesture back to Felix.
But then Felix took that work and made a curtain of gold, didn't he, that was a reference in you?
Yeah, what it was, I'm going to forget the name, Untitled Placebo Landscape for Ronnie, something like that. And it's a candy piece, gold candy spread out on the floor.
Yeah.
And I thought, oh, yeah, well, I can't top that one.
Yeah.
You know, it's just like, wow. And then I responded with the paired gold mat.
Right, right, right. But it's the seconds off thing as well, the element. Like when we talked about earlier about your photographs, when you look at your paired photographs, you think it's the same image, but it's actually seconds later the second image has been taken. But, you know, this is about what looking and looking again. And his perfect lovers, these clocks which are on the wall, they're always, as much as they're perfect, they're always a few seconds off. And there's some poetry in that, that as much as they're just like a man-made clock and they should be the same, they're always a few seconds off, and your work, these photographs, are always a few seconds off, and you like that challenge of making you look and look again.
Well, I think that's part of it, but I think if you look a little more closely, Russell, you'll find that some of those pairs may be identical.
Oh really? Okay, all right. I like looking for...
It's not like you're going to have a definitive aha with any of them, because you're just going to... It just keeps you in motion.
Engaged, yeah.
You in play. The doubt will keep you in play.
Right.
The lack of ability to absolutely resolve with 100% certainty keeps you in play. That's what I want. I want you in play.
I've always really liked that, because I think it's like this kind of... provocation or something, but there's also just that openness, you know, to thinking, because you're allowing the viewer to think and to engage actively, you know, with the actual idea of viewing your work. It's I love the work in 2006, Portrait of an Image, where you photograph the French actress Isabelle Huppert, and the way that those images, even though they're not doubles as such, they're more like different takes. With different facial expressions. But those facial expressions kind of wouldn't have existed necessarily in the real world, because they're performances she's giving. So those facial expressions only can exist either in film, you know, when she's playing the character like Russell does when in his day job of acting, or in your photography shoot, you know, of you in that photography film. Can you speak a bit about that project? Because that was a work by you that really captured my imagination.
Well, yeah, the Portrait of an Image, I thought of it as photographing somebody that had an image that was not her, but was organic to her. So I asked Isabelle effectively to impersonate herself in various roles she'd played. So what we did was, and this is what she wanted me to put all the roles that of hers in a hat. And she would pull out one every day and she would go into character. Wow. You know, and that's what I was photographing, you know. And It was a really fascinating experience because it became clear that she wanted to know what I wanted. And I knew what I wanted, but I didn't know what it looked like. So that was the position I was in. So there's a little bit of like toughness in the dynamic, but you know, I managed to squeak through without giving, making something up because I didn't know what I was, you know. And that often is the case with me, that I know what I want, but I don't know what it looks like. And that's partly why I move among different idioms. To get to things, you know, that I'm drawn to.
It was like she was looking for the director in you as the actress.
She was.
Yeah.
It was. It's an interesting thing. You see why so many actors, actresses, and actors have sexual relationships with directors, because there is a dominance element involved there. You know.
Tell me what to do.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it was really. I was visiting a writer that I enjoyed over the years. You may know her, Hélène Cixous. She's a French, quite an extraordinary author and thinker. And I wanted them to meet because it was a little mischievous on my part, because Hélène is a Jewish intellectual, right? And she's all consciousness. It's like pure consciousness. She's like all idea. And Isabel really is a deeply intuitive person, you know. And I knew Isabel was interested in Hélène. So I brought Hélène to one of Isabel's performances. And then we all went to dinner and we had sea urchin.
Oh, did you?
You know, that was like everybody loves sea urchin, which was really a very intimate thing, you know. So... And it was fun because watching the two of them talk about sea urchin, the whole thing was amazing. So, I mean, I stayed out to the side because it was like when I did a project with John Waters and again Hélène Cixous and a couple of other artists. But John Waters and Hélène Cixous are like, you know, you can imagine. Well, again, this hyper intellectual and this very. He's certainly not anti-intellectual, but he has got a whole different idea of intelligence and extremely effective with it. Yes. But the key really was that John is a deeply generous person in spirit. So he embraces people with his humor, and he opens, like a can of sardines, he'll open you up with his humor, you know? And he's not judgmental, even though it's obvious where he comes from.
Yeah.
And I just love watching that too. I'm a kind of a voyeur at heart.
Is John a good gift giver? Did he feature in your series?
He didn't, but I'll tell you something about John. He has these wonderful Christmas cards, which are all unique, you know, that he generates through, he commissions friends or somebody, and they're always something to look forward to. So.
And actually, Russ, we were gifted a few of his books by his publisher last year, which I loved. I mean, I thought his last book was extraordinary.
Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello, this is Russell Tovey and Robert Diamond from Talk Arts, the arts podcast, and we're here today with Budweiser beer, and we're going to be talking about something very, very important to both of us, aren't we, Rob?
That's right. Budweiser, the king of beers, has joined forces with legendary artist Sir Peter Blake, the godfather of British pop art and someone that both of us have adored since we were kids.
I've loved pop art since I was a kid, and Sir Peter Blake has been a constant for me, alongside other pop art artists, the Americans like Andy Warhol, Roy Lichtenstein, Keith Haring. And I got into pop art, Rob, because I loved cartoons growing up. I mean, I still love animation. But suddenly I discovered that so many artists were referencing comic strips and cartoons in their artworks, and I could go and see them in museums, and I suddenly didn't need to grow up. And Sir Peter Blake was one of these artists that meant so much to me. And I think people, if they don't know the name Sir Peter Blake, you would certainly know his work. The album cover for The Beatles, Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club, Oasis's Stop the Clocks. These are iconic art historical moments that this artist has actually been at the forefront of.
And you've met him, haven't you?
I've met him, yeah, at the South Bank Show Awards years ago. I was there for the History Boys, and he was there, and I got incredibly excited and met him. But you've not met him before, have you, Rob?
I have. I've actually even been to his house and hung out with him and his wife, and I got to make an amazing print with him, which was a huge privilege, actually. It was a real career moment for me. So Budweiser and Sir Peter Blake have come together to unite, and they have created an exclusive limited edition beer can, which doubles as a collectible piece of pop art.
And it was on display at London's Truerman Brewery on the 23rd and 24th of March this year, if you were lucky enough to get there. And also, were you one of the lucky few that were able to get one of the signed beer cans by Sir Peter Blake himself? And there was something very special there, wasn't there, Rob? What was that?
They've actually made the first ever fridge frame, which kind of is reminiscent of what we would be, you know, accustomed with in terms of a museum exhibit. Yeah. But this fridge frame is designed to display the limited edition can of beer as a work of art, but also keeps the beer cool.
Okay, I need a fridge full of fridge frames because this sounds incredible. So Peter Blake's work adorns the cans with all of his eye-catching simplicity. It features the Budweiser's iconic red bow tie logo, but it's encompassed by the artist's signature and his use of block colours and icons. They unveiled this artistic can in all of its glory in one of these fridge frames, as Rob said, which is very exciting. The limited edition cans are available to purchase as a four-pack for a limited time only in selected Tesco stores nationwide.
Budweiser and Sir Peter Blake, thank you for bringing us this cultural moment. I love it when art reaches new audiences, and I really feel like this is going to go into everyone's homes, and is really joyous. So head over to Tesco, pick up a four-pack. Thank you, Budweiser.
But also, if you want to get this collectible piece of art at home, Budweiser also giving people the chance to own their very own exclusive fridge frame. Beer and art lovers can register their interest by visiting www.budweiser.co.uk/Sir Peter Blake collab. That's budweiser.co.uk/Sir Peter Blake collab. Budweiser and Talk Art with Sir Peter Blake.
You know, talking about words, you mentioned earlier with that list of gifts. Now, I find it so interesting the way that you create art, because like you were saying, there is a kind of very open dialogue between all the different mediums, because you've made things with glass, you know, photography, like installation, sculpture, and also literature plays such an important kind of almost like a consistent theme in the work. And one of the things that really resonated with me was what you mentioned earlier, Emily Dickinson, because the poetry of Emily Dickinson had a big influence on me as a songwriter when I was in my teenage years. And I was obsessed with things like I Felt a Funeral in My Brain and, you know, all these different poems. And I loved that sort of led to a work of aluminium word kind of text-based sculptures. Can you speak a bit about those? Because I thought one of them in particular is perfect for the era we've been living through. You know, everyone has had this shared experience in lockdown. You know, the one that says, to shut our eyes is travel. Love it. Can you speak a bit about that body
beautiful.
Of work?
And so obvious, you know, that is like... Well, this is one of the things that I love about Dickinson, and what I think my creative energy is I relate it to what she does in her practice, because again, you go back to this self-evidence, you know, a self-evident or transparent thing. So when somebody says two butterflies went out at noon, think, well, that's a fact, you know, which most 99% of the population of the world never took note of, you know, but and she is taking note. And that's the story. That's my connection to her, that she, that everything is fodder for her potential.
Yeah.
Yeah, to bear witness.
And I relate, and I relate strongly to that personally. And I felt when I, you know, when Dickinson was finally published extensively, they numbered her poems.
Yes, they did.
Right. So she didn't have titles. She had first lines and there were numbers, which were not hers. But anyway, you would use the first lines to find her what poem you were you wanted. And they became the key and cues. So Two Butterflies Went Out at Noon, or Dust Is the Only Secret. These are first lines taken from her poems. Yeah. From because the index is always, if you ever want to have a kind of a synoptic view of Emily Dickinson's work, just read the index of first lines. It's exquisite.
Wow.
And you can see that a lot of them are unto themselves as well.
Yes. And how did that become these physical kind of manifestations in a way of those words? Because they're extraordinary sculptures. And that's what I find so unusual about your work, is that even though everything's so different, it all feels like you. And the minute I see it, you know it's Ronnie Horne. Do you know what I mean? Even the glass sculptures or all of your work. It's got a
I'm always looking for the other one, though. I'm always going like, where's... Because sometimes the water sculptures are in different rooms. I was walking and go, right, where's the other Ronnie? It's here somewhere.
Exactly. Well, yeah, I've gotten the Pavlovian response out of my audience now. And every now and then I pull it away.
Yeah, you're like, where is it?
Yeah. Right, here are 10. Yeah. Here's a group. I can't say exactly. It was my desire to have those first lines experienced as a view. And so I thought of a first line. I'm trying to think of a good one to give you. Oh God, my mind.
My flowers are near and foreign. That was one.
Yeah, that's a good one.
Yeah.
Yeah. That it was complete in itself. It didn't, you don't need the rest of the poem, but if you have the rest of the poem, you'll have another experience. Yeah. And you really go places, you know, in it. Or probably a good one for us is a pansy, something about a pansy and a pang.
Uh-huh. That's me and Rob, yeah.
That's like, oh my
And maybe me on certain days, you know, because some people do think I'm a pansy. I mean, they think I'm mistaken both ways. And I've never been comfortable with it, but I've always cultivated it because it seemed to feel, getting into the androgyny, I'm changing subjects, but it was the place I was most comfortable, but it didn't make it comfortable in itself because you're always dealing with people who weren't comfortable without having a tag, you know.
Yeah, a label. Yeah.
And it really was difficult when I was younger, but I didn't have options. But going back to Dickinson, I wanted this idea of a view in a room. And it wasn't going to be descriptive. I don't get involved descriptively, not even photographically. I wanted the view in the room to be through the viewer, right? As opposed to like looking out at Mount Fuji, which is another idea of a view. This is one that you would find by looking out of yourself to look into yourself.
Right.
And that's the way I thought of it. So I wanted to give it objecthood that way.
The interior, but in a physical form.
Well, to leverage that interior space that each viewer has.
Right.
You know, catalyzing that through the first line.
Okay.
Right.
Do you know what I mean?
I think so.
Where you get like, I'm trying to think of, a rat surrendered here. How's that?
Nice.
You know, well, so... You know, where do you go with that? You're not thinking about the word rat. Once you've read it, You're in the sewer, man. Mm. You're like in some kind of place, not where you are. Well, I am. I'll tell you where I go, you know. You know, so that's what I mean by a view.
And that's
and
about
your view.
Moving
At that point,
you.
It's your view.
Yeah, it's like transporting the viewer.
It's about closing your eyes. Your imagination moves you somewhere. If you're told something, you instantly go.
So that's how you. That's how it's a cue. That's why I call it key and cue, because it cues you to something that then is a jumping point into your interior space.
Yeah.
So
we touched on. Yeah, totally beautiful. We touched on androgyny and otherness, and how much does that play into your practice?
Well, I think it has to play all the time because it's what I live. It's my lived experience. But to be honest with you, I think all the doubling is coming out of something there, connected to my personal affinities. But I'm not really naming it. I prefer not to name things in my practice as best I can, and to keep it open-ended or ambiguous, because I think it's richer and more inclusive.
Mm.
You know, I think the beauty of androgyny is that it is, you're integrating the difference, not excluding it. Mm-hmm. Like you say, oh, I'm a man. Well, you're excluding everything that's not a man. And why would you do that? I mean, why would I do that? I want it all, man. I'm like a hedonist at heart. I want everything. So that's how I think of it for myself.
I think there's a body of work which really resonates with me with ambiguity is 2008 Bird, which is a series of taxidermied Icelandic birds shot from behind. Again, many of them doubled. But there's something so kind of, it plays with gender, because from behind they feel like they're kind of fluid beings that have long hair, or they're wearing a cloak, or they're
totally,
they have personalities. They're the backs of birds' heads, which we don't look at, and you're photographing them and giving them, making us bear witness to that. But they really challenge you because they look so human from behind.
Some of them, I mean, you know, you wouldn't believe some of the likenesses people have told me. Like it's Al Sharpton. I don't know if you know who he is, but he's this kind of very bombastic politician, black politician in New York politics. And that's the Raven, the Black Raven.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, yeah, there's a lot of that association. And it is kind of wonderful because it's sort of an entrance that's slightly humorous, but also it's really just really there, baseline there.
There's also something quite rich and luscious about them because of the feathers.
Oh,
I mean,
the feathers,
birds
generally,
like, oh, and a bird like flew into my house as a kid and it, you know, sadly hit the window and it you know, didn't survive.
Yeah.
But when my mum was taking it out of the kitchen, I remember looking at it and being like, how fragile and precious they are. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like the kind of wondrous beauty of nature and also the tragedy of it at the same time. This kind of, something so extraordinary about plumage and...
They're very sexual, and I like that too. It's like, in that way, it's confrontational, some of them, I think, because they're so phallic. But if you see the whole suite, it plays out quite
stunning.
Quite the full range of possibilities there.
Yeah, and they go within your oeuvre of the very plain white background, and they're photographed very starkly lit. It's stunning. I think also the title Bird, as well, kind of has a gender connotation that in the UK would call, you know, bird.
Absolutely,
there's something that plays into
English
that.
English really use that word more than the Americans, but I love that idea that a bird, you know, has that connotation. And most people in the States, I don't know that they get that level, that reading on it. But I'll tell you something about photographing bird. I went to Iceland in February, which, you know, it's basically only 4 hours of light. So it's kind of, and I photograph exclusively in daylight. So I had to be quick on the draw there. But I was looking to photo, there was a certain element for a work that I did called Pi, which is a kind of a key piece for me, which was mostly photographed up along the Arctic Circle of Iceland. But I was missing one motif, which was the mink. I had a lot of the indigenous animals of Iceland in this work, but the mink, which was an interloper, it was brought in for economic reasons and then proceeded to decimate the ecology. So I wanted this represented in this work. And I wound up finding a museum outside of Reykjavik where they had all these taxidermied animals, including minks and stuff. And they had a huge collection of the native birds. And so I thought, oh, wow, this is, you know, I wound up photographing. I would schlep these things outside the museum. And it was a white painted concrete wall. Set it up on a table with the white concrete wall as a background and photograph it in the few hours of light I had. That's the way they were photographed. So,
how long did it take?
Very low tech. I was there for a couple of weeks doing it every day.
Wow. And do you work on digital or you do film?
Well, at that time it was film, unfortunately.
Even more preparation.
And you develop them yourself? Do you have your own dark room and everything you develop?
No, them? I don't. I'm not really. I usually order out for okay. most activities except the drawing. Yeah. The drawing I do myself.
Drawing you do every day, right? This is something that is automatic to you.
Often, yeah. Often I go through a daily process. Sometimes that's all I do. You know, right now I'm in a drawing phase, so I have a show going up, which is all drawing.
Yeah, so let's talk about that, because I heard you describe drawing as breathing, like, you know, as almost like equating to that's how important it is to you.
When I draw, I breathe, yeah.
Yes, exactly. What I'm saying there is really for myself, that drawing is the one thing I did for many, many, many years and had no desire or need to show it to anybody. It was just about me realizing a certain continuity in my life, because the other works I did, whether they were photographic or artist books or sculptures, they're really kind of concept pieces. They take a long time to develop and produce, and there's no continuity, you know? With the drawing, I start in the visual and I end in the visual every step of the way. And that was something I needed for myself until they became something more than me, or I felt they were something more than me. I was willing to then show it to the public. But it is very much for me an exercise, not an exercise, but like a breathing, because it's what gives me continuity.
And can you talk about Log? This new major work, which you'll be showing for the first time. So I think you began that in, was it March 2019? And then it ran to May 2020, is that correct?
Correct.
That was actually memorized. I don't know how I remembered that, but I did.
Yeah, well, I'm impressed. You can do my biography, honey bunch. What happened there? It was before the pandemic started, and I was going upstate to work on some drawings for a new show, which was eventually postponed because of the pandemic. But what I felt that I needed to do, or what I was moving towards, was having a daily practice, which was not about being facile or having technique, but it was very much about me and my relationship to the world. So I committed for a year I would do something every day. And so I said, okay, the format is just like a piece of writing paper. So it's that size. And then whatever came to me that day, whether it was a current event like a black hole in the news, the first photograph of the black hole, now that just set me off wildly conceptually. With, you know, think about that, you know, distance far away is over, you know, all those things that you grew up thinking, that relationship, everything was somehow automatically compressed like that. So, and that filters into other, if you think of them as drawings, each page, now the drawing can include writing, and it mostly does, either formal writing, casual notations, current events, a lot about the weather, actual drawings, just visual drawings that have nothing to do with anything but me, very playful. Most of it is very playful. My humor is in there, which is very important to me. Just humor in general is very important to me. A lot of quotations from reading, you know, so it's got all these different elements and no rules except for that one a day or something every day. Mm. Something could be three pages or three drawings, but every day, you know. And so when I'm traveling, it was something I could do anywhere. And there was no right or wrong to it.
Yeah, it sounds quite liberating in a way, doesn't it? Like, it kind of, with that very simple rule, it almost takes away the pressure because there's no expectation of having to deliver something extraordinary. It's quite intimate, personal, you and your hand and your
exactly.
brain. It's like,
it's just me, and we'll see what to say it's up to.
Yeah. Who do you look
at? It's up to anything, you know? Yeah. But I wanted to, it felt really good to me. You're right, liberating might be the word, because it was just letting it hang out, you know? It was just, it is a kind of autobiographical thing, or self-portrait, however. It's both visual and language-based, so it shares. But it's autobiographical, not of me, Ronnie Horn, doing this, doing that. It's a sensibility and what underlies my work and what kind of the web of it, the net of my work is held, is very evident in Log.
Wow.
You get a lot of pairing.
Yeah. Yes. Well, so I've got lots of things circled around for you. So we've got Iceland, yeah. big circle, water, big circle, drawing, big circle, doubling, repetition, literature, the motorcycle feels like it's been a big thing for you. But then I've also got circled Missy Elliott.
Yes.
Yeah, Missy Elliott. Yeah, she's a big thing for me. It's like Aretha Franklin, you know, there's certain voices and persona out there in the public that are inimitable. They're just quite unique. So, I have to say, black women have had more influence on me than just about any one thing. The energy they put out in the world, their creative achievements, and certainly in literature and in music especially, but now in politics, I'm blown away by the strongest voices in the room.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so Missy Elliott is quite, I think, quite unique even in the in that culture that she is working
totally.
Within. And yeah.
There was an exhibition in Seoul in South Korea called Remembered Words. And that is linked to your drawing practice. And it was actually the first time you showed that whole series of that work, which references Missy Elliott, the Supremes, and it has kind of watercolor with
yeah.
words. Can you talk a bit about that specific
yeah.
thing? Because we'll post images of that on our Instagram, because I love that series.
It's just this arbitrary nature of language, you know, associating, you know what, kiddo, what I need to turn you on to, I would love to share with you, and if I get your address, I'll send you a copy of something called Remembered Words, a Specimen Concordance.
Uh-huh.
Which is the concordance of all the drawings, without the drawings, just the words. Meaning, if you think about remembered words, where I'm just sitting there pulling words out of my head, these are the things that come to me. Sometimes they come to me 100 times. Sometimes they only come once in all the drawings. Not 100 times, but, you know, mm-hmm. a dozen times, let's say. So, and once I alphabetized them, I just thought, oh, Jesus, this is... It's hysterical, number one, because of some of the word slippage, you know, I could read to you from it. I think you'll enjoy
love
it.
That. Have you got it there?
Yeah, we'd love that. Yes, please.
Yes, this is like
Here's the
so
book.
Wild.
It's this little...
please.
Can you see it? Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
So is that published around the same time, like 2018?
Yeah, maybe 2018. That's about right, I think. So... Here you go. This is the cover, you know, which is a section of the book. You've got, let's start with miscegenation, miserable, misfit, Miss Piggy, Mississippi, Missy Elliott, Mr. Tibbs, Mysterioso, Misty, MIT, Mitigate, Miter, Mitzvah, and on and so on. How about Mr. Clean, Mr. Klein, which is the film. That's a fantastic film. Mr. Magoo, Mr. Potato Head, Mount Terror, Mumbo Jumbo, Murmuration, Murphy, as in Beckett, Murphy bed, Murphy's law, you know, it's just all the different elements of, here's Crazy Cat and Kreutzer Sonata on the back. The Lady from Shanghai and Lagavulin. Lake Baikal and Lake Placid. Leave It to Beaver and Leaves of Grass. Lee Marvin. The Left Hand of Darkness. Leftovers. I can go on, man. It's an 80-page book of... You can see that it's listed. I actually give the number of incidences that occur. I give the misspellings because a lot of the words
are
misspelled.
Let's do all 80 pages now, Ronnie. Come on.
You know, I want to do that. It's just funny you were asking me because I definitely have an interest to do that.
To make like an audio.
Do a performance where.
It'd be amazing.
Or exact. Where the audience can walk in and out and have this background, like white noise of the language.
I've got some like memory of like a song that has murmuration in it or murmuration or something. Like I don't know who that is.
Is it you saying water? Is it that one? Ronnie Horne saying water?
Yeah, saying water, yeah. That I would call a performance.
And, that was a monologue, yeah.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah. And I'd love to do this as a monologue, you know.
Let's make it happen. Come and do it in
London.
No,
you've said it.
Well, let's talk about... Yeah, let's talk about the UK, but London especially, and we're in the UK now, and I love the fact that you have had such an affinity, like this, that you Talking Water was written while you were staying in that one-bedroom hotel that was on top of the Queen Elizabeth Hall in London.
Love that story.
You used that. The Thames, obviously, is a big influence. Yeah. How much has London played into you personally and your work, or the UK in general?
That's an interesting question. I'm not sure it has really that much. I obviously the water thing, but also I did do something for the BBC, which was Weather Reports You. I don't know if you know that work.
No.
It's a book that I published, which was part of Library of Water up in Iceland. Library of Water is the collection of glacial waters from throughout Iceland. That was it was a building that was opened in 2007 with Art Angel.
Exactly.
You know, Art Angel's been a big presence in my life, James Lingwood especially. Yeah. He asked me to do the first international collaboration, and we did this in Iceland Library.
And they did a trip, didn't they? They took a load of like collectors and art fans over from the UK to see the Library of Water. I was invited on it, and sadly I was away at the time and I couldn't be there. But I remember James Lingwood mentioning
it. You missed it, baby. We have the best musicians at those open houses. You know, the Icelandic scene's amazing for music. And we have amazing, we've had amazing, you know, one-off concerts for like 40 people. I don't know what you fit in there. But they're all situated among these floor-to-ceiling water columns. And some of the columns contain water from glaciers that no longer exist, which is kind of intense to think about now. But so one part of this was it's a community center with this collection of water in it. But then the other part of it was Weather Reports You, which was going out and collecting, getting people to talk about their life in the weather. You know, and people had all kinds of wonderful stories or just psychological connections to the weather that they were quite talkative about. You had to edit pretty heavily, you know. Mm-hmm. But so I did a book, which is called Weather Reports You, and it's a collection of maybe 100 of these. And they're not interviews. They're edited so they're just an individual speaking, each individual, an oral history in a way of the weather. And actually, I included a fair number of them in Island Zombie, this new Princeton University book. So you can even get an idea. I think the original artist book is out of print, or I'm told it is. I don't know. But so you can get a little bit of it from Island Zombie. And those profiles, when I went, I tried to do it in Japan. Wasn't an option because the Japanese have a level of reticence about everything. Even the weather is not small talk. There is nothing that's small talk in Iceland. I mean, in Japan. In Iceland, they're very stoic, but they eventually talk about it. And it's quite clear how profoundly it shapes their lives. You go to England, and obviously weather is huge, you know, but in a very, very different way. It's more like not a complaint, but a...
It's a complaint.
An obstacle to deal with mostly. And so I did, it was a very short BBC thing where we had a number of journalists go out and pull these interviews from, I can't remember what part of England we chose. It was quite a while ago. And that was oral. So it was just a recording for BBC Radio. And I was quite happy with that. I never got any feedback, but I enjoyed that.
Cool.
Very different range. And I like the way it becomes a kind of collective portrait of a place. You know,
it's a good one as well, because in England it's always actually, like, oh, it's raining today. Oh, it was so cold yesterday.
Oh, it's great.
Oh, it's so hot.
Oh, it's beautiful.
It's never good. Yeah. It's always like there's a problem with the weather.
Mm-hmm.
And I look at, when I'm in England, I do notice that the quality of the light and the weather are very, very moving to me. And I love it, you know? So, but I don't have to live there, you know?
Yeah.
So it's easy to talk
sometimes
about.
When it gets it right, it is pretty powerful, the United Kingdom. So every guest that comes on, we asked them all the same two questions at the end. And the first one is, Ronnie, if you could do an art heist, if you could have any work of art in the world for yourself, what would it be and why?
Oh, God, that's an interesting variation on a very obnoxious question.
Mm-hmm.
you know, I'm always terrified by this because there just is so much I'd want to take.
Because you're right. You seem like a collector at heart, Ronnie. You seem like you're someone who... Do you collect art?
No, not really. I have art, but I wouldn't call myself a collector. But, you know, Russell, I think that in the work, there are a lot of collections of things. So
yes.
In some sense, yeah.
You're an archivist.
Yeah. Something there. Yeah, but with like the gift piece that is and the remembered word. So I think there is a lot of collecting going on, but it's not really so much objects and things. What would I, maybe a room full of Cycladic objects.
Okay.
Or, the Codex by Leonardo da Vinci.
What are those? The Codex? What are those?
The drawings of, depending, there are a few, depending on, like water turbulence or cloud studies, you know, things like
that. Wow.
I love those drawings. Just absolutely love them. She might, but I know that Bill Gates bought it for Microsoft because he wanted to. One of them he did buy and try to digitize them and make them, you know, commercially available. Yeah, well. Well, that was one idea anyway. I'm a big fan of the Turner cloud studies, you know, and the Constable cloud studies. I find because it sits right at the juncture of abstraction and depiction, really. Mm. And that's where I really find myself kind of gravitating towards. But, you know, having said that, then I wouldn't mind a wall of soutine. Drawings by Van Gogh.
They're all drawings, Ronnie. Everything you're pulling on is drawings. Apart from the objects at the beginning, they feel like you're very drawn to sketching.
I am drawn to drawings, but soutine is really painting, but they're drawings in my mind. But drawing is a much more encompassing form for me than for most people, I think. It's not works on paper. I mean, that's just one thing. I think of all my work primarily as drawing. You know, even the photography, editing and composing. There's a lot of drawing activity in these processes. You know, they're basically it's basically a dialectic interaction with something. To draw out, to take aim, to metamorphose. All of these things are really definitions of drawing. So I've kind of thought of myself mainly as someone who draws. You know, even when I write. So what's the other obnoxious question?
This is a really obnoxious one, which I wouldn't mind actually asking you about your own work, because I feel like, anyway, I'll ask you the question first. The question is, what is your favorite color? The addendum to that is just your work has such an interesting use of colour, like generally, and I'm quite interested to quickly explore that. I know we've been talking for a long time, but if you think about your glass work, for example, even the amber ones, like just the fascination and there's such a consistency of colour throughout your work, which is extraordinary, I think.
Well, you know, in glass, colour is at its best because it's half light, you know, and in most experiences of colour, you're dealing with reflected light, not transmitted light. So the light inhabits the colour. And so you're going to have a very, very different experience of colour in glass, not in plastic or, as we say, resin, you know, for example, in glass, you know. In my drawings, it's almost irrelevant. I just sort of, with big pigment drawings, I just am using color based on the mechanical properties of the pigment I'm working with. So like cadmium is very adhesive and it's very, it forms a thick paste very easily. Versus, let's say, the ultramarine colors. They're very thin and very difficult to work with without a binder, you know, more like the Eve Klein way of
pigment.
Just the pureness of the blue. So in that there, I'm not really paying so much attention to the actual color, but I am, you're right, Robert, color really. But the problem is that what you're observing is interesting. My interesting use of color is because I can't distinguish hierarchically between them. Because when a color is used properly, it's brilliant. And even if, let's just say, like a lemon yellow would be one of my least favorite colors. Let's say I don't want to paint my bedroom in lemon yellow. But I've seen lemon yellow used where it was just like you cannot use another. It's perfect and brilliant. And I love it. You know what I mean? It's really about context color. But also, I love the cultural specificity of color. Like you get Fujichrome, Kodachrome, Agfa from Germany, Ilford from England. The color range is completely different, you know? Like Fuji is very high saturated. You see it in Asian printing as well. They tend to saturate, you know, color very – and they want contrast and clarity. Whereas, let's say, the Dutch and the English – it's much more, there's more presence about the color. It's not about graphics, not at all. And you see, especially with the Dutch, they're quieter tonal, much quieter tonal range. The Russians are all like, oh, that's the color from like 1930. And they just keep 1930 as contemporary color. They carry it forward in all the printing I've seen. Wow. It is a fascinating thing to see how culturally specific. Kodak is into flesh color. Now that means obviously Caucasian. And they would balance the chemistry so that white flesh tone, which is extremely difficult.
Yeah, I read a really interesting New York Times article about that and almost like the racism within it somehow or this. It was a really
fascinating
article.
With the assumptions that were, you know, they did it with Band-Aids too, you know, like
ballet shoes.
Skin colored Band-Aids, you know, that kind of thing. But with Kodak, that also the software ruins the chance of photographing somebody's face. It limits the range, and you have to get rid of those algorithms so you can get whatever the sunlight's doing with them, and not what the culture wants to see in it.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
So yeah, you know, you often look better than you really look in a Kodak photograph.
Right.
It's got nothing to do with you.
The chemicals.
Yeah.
Oh, Ronnie.
Yeah.
So if you had to pick one color over all others, it obviously wouldn't be lemon yellow for you, but is there one or can you not do that?
Well, I can't, because when I think, oh, Prussian green, I know I'm thinking about a color in an oil set I had when I was a kid. You know, who the fuck knows what Prussian green is? Maybe Naples yellow. It's this kind of chalky white yellow that just is very moody, you know, and neutral.
I like that.
I never had either of those answers, so I'll take both.
Talking about the then and now, and you just sent back to your, like, having a childhood paint, but How do you feel about the world we're in now? And you talked about when you was younger and struggling with identity and in the mainstream and where you fit in society. How do you feel about the world we're in now and kids growing up and being in the same position that you were in then? Do you think the world's a better, more open, welcoming place? Are you inspired by how it is? Or do you find it still for yourself and looking down, looking around at other people, it's difficult still?
I'm very much of a pragmatist that way. What I see is an overpopulated world, and people are getting overall nastier and nastier. So because of the competitive aspects of things, you know, having space for yourself is a luxury now, you know,
yes.
Never forget about food sources and clean water, clean air. I mean, they're all endangered, but I think the overpopulation has limited the possibility of our becoming more humane, which is we were sort of on that path for a while. And then it seemed like entropy was really catching up with us linguistically. It was like, it's almost like language doesn't work anymore. If you watch what goes on in the States, I don't know, the politics are so divisive, so toxic, so unbridgeable. And I think obviously you guys in England have been through a hell of a lot with this Brexit thing, which was like Russia's fantasy of how to destroy you. In my mind, that's what was really going on, even though I know a lot of people voted. You had this, frankly, an idiot, this guy Cameron, come in and think that this was something to throw out to the people to make a decision about when, of course, they didn't know what they were really voting on. It's like calling people who think Obamacare is socialist and they're getting it and they're down on it, but they need it, you know, mm-hmm. and they're criticizing it, but they don't even know where it comes from. And it's the same thing with Brexit. You know, so many of the qualities of England came through the free movement. Obviously, there are problems with it, too. There's no question. But let's say a better leadership could have emphasized other things than the leaders we have had. And where they have brought people who need leaders. Most people seem to need to be herded, from what I can tell, watching the whole phenomenon around Trump and the Republicans and all of this. It's very shocking to me. The level of discourse is so, so abysmal and without care for difference, people who are different, you know, or respect for people who are different. So to be honest with you, I don't feel we're in a better place. And the scale is so enormous in complexity. And there seem to be some never-ending themes about power and tyranny that have not changed one iota. And, you know.
Then I guess on the flip side, hopefully there are still positive people, like hopefully the three of us in this room, in this imaginary room right now, where we're all connected. But I do believe in the power of art as well. I know some people don't think it has that power, but I do still. And actually, there's a phrase in your current show, which is about to open at Houser & Worth, which says, "I am paralyzed with hope." And I loved that phrase. I thought it was, it really resonated. Sorry. And I think it's a beautiful kind of thought to end this conversation on. Plus, there's another thing I took out of one of the drawings, which was Elvis has left the building.
Correct. And that is a fact. It's like two butterflies went out at noon. But let me end with one thought, because I feel so uncomfortable about this. I am paralyzed with hope is a drawing that recurs in Log. There are six variations. This is a quote from Maria Bamford, who's a stand-up comedian. And somehow that got left out of the photograph, of the press image. And so, yes, they're my drawings, but the quote is Maria Bamford's. That's very important to me. She's really kind of a radical comedian who is bipolar, and she riffs on this reality. It's really quite good. So, yeah, I stole that from her.
It's just set the record straight. Yeah, cool.
Yeah, no, I can't. That freaks me out.
But also, you've introduced it to a whole new audience. So you've given it a platform. You're sharing her thoughts.
No, it's my. I picked it, baby. You know, I'm a good curator.
Yeah, you are.
You selected it.
Yeah. Listen, you guys have been so lovely to share with.
Thank you.
You really
so
bring
much.
Out the best in certainly in me, but imagine in
you've been incredibly generous and open with us, and I can't thank you enough. When you know earlier when you cut out briefly, I was just like, Russell, I think I'm in love. Like, I love you.
Yeah. You're
amazing.
I was going through withdrawal too,
and I love your work as well. But I had no idea, like. You know, who you would be, because I've never even met you or anything, but it's just such a wonderful thing to meet you.
Thank you, guys.
Thank you so much. And I really hope we do one day get to meet in the real
world. I would really love that. Yeah.
Well, for all images we talked about today, please go on the Talkart Instagram. Ronnie, do you have social media? Are you on Instagram?
I'm not personally, but I hear there are some things out there through other people. But
yep. We can check your hashtag. They can find you on Instagram. And
you can go to... At Houser Worth, I think.
Okay.
Right. But stick around, and we'll talk to you after we've come off air. But thank you very much, everyone, for listening. We'll see you next time, and thanks, Ronnie.
We'll be back very soon. Thanks for listening. Bye,
thank
Ronnie.
You.
You've been listening to Talkart with Robert Diamond and Russell Tovey.
Follow us on Instagram at Talkart, where you can view images of all artworks discussed in today's episode, with music by Jack Northover.
Subscribe to Talkart at Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Acast, or wherever it is that you get your podcasts.
Give us a rating and write us a comment. Thanks for listening.